It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
This is the first one we've done after the live show.
It is, and we very much enjoyed it.
We did.
The live show itself will come out as a podcast
at a later date.
But yeah. I thought I could tell a little story about something that happened after the live show.
Yes.
So I'd mentioned that a few people were hanging around wanting selfies with you, which I know you always enjoy. So you'd gone out to meet them. And somebody came up to me and they said, Jeff, can I have a selfie with you? And I said, are you just asking me this out of pity? And he said, yes. Yes, I am. So I said, so am I right in thinking that you don't really want a selfie with me? No. He says, no, I was just waiting for one with Ed, really. So I said, so should we not do it? Because otherwise it's just going to take up your time, like deleting it off your phone afterwards. And he went, yeah, I think you're probably right.
That's terrible. Joel, how many times have I told you not to do that? I'm really sorry. I feel terrible.
No, it was
now.
Funny. It was all very good natured. It was making me laugh a lot.
There were lots of people who asked for selfies with me, but really wanted you in it.
I know, but I think people are thinking to themselves, well, I suppose I can always crop it at a later date.
No, I don't think that's true at all. What amusing byproduct of the live show for me was that you were looking for things to have indicative votes on, and one of them was about, well, whether our family should get a dog, which my children would quite like. But also what their bedtime should be. And this caused some sort of, am I allowed to say, a brouhaha?
A little bit of a brouhaha, a stramash
in the house, because you had a vote on whether they should be allowed to stay up till 8 p.m. to watch documentaries, as they put it, very responsibly. So then we had the vote, and it was overwhelmingly, obviously, plain to the crowd that they should be allowed to stay up. But then there was a sort of slightly awkward sort of situation where it was like they were like, well, okay, well, that's the decision then.
So it got to bedtime, the normal bedtime, which is
well, it got to being on the way home from the tube, and it being whatever it was, 6 something, and them saying, oh, well, we can stay up till 8, can't we? I said no, and they said, well, we've just had a vote.
So this has shaken their faith in democracy,
or me, I think.
But
it's quite an interesting parenting lesson, because I've then discussed it further, and apparently what I should have done is I should have said, when I was on the stage playing to the crowd, I went, oh, right, I must have said something affirmative.
Yes.
So they got the signal that this was okay, and the dad was sort of saying, fine. Whereas I should have said, well, you know, we'll definitely think about it. So I should have been.
It's only an advisory vote.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. I should, or maybe we want a second one. I should have been more conditional.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
Well, there we go. I was feeling bad because it had caused you a little bit of familial disharmony, but now I feel good because you've learned a lesson.
I definitely have learned a lesson. I think it was quite an interesting lesson.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
That I was too much. I was too much like, well, here's the sort of show reality, and I'll be. That's fine. And then having no intention of putting it into effect. So there we go.
Good. And we're going to be doing another live show.
People can buy tickets for the June 23rd one, yes?
Yeah, it's another one on the South Bank in London, but we're going to get a few more.
Tickets selling fast.
Yes, they are, actually.
Yeah.
We're not just saying that to try and...
Not
just to encourage panic buying. No. So this week's episode, then.
So we're talking about a subject close to your heart and mine.
Something fashion.
Something on which we're both... I'm trying to say the word expert and it's somehow not coming out of my mouth. Something on which we both have thoughts.
So I don't think anybody has a photograph of either me or you on their Pinterest board when they're trying to work out what their look for the next season is going to be.
No, but you know, I've got suddenly thought something, which is that there is a... I won't embarrass him, but there's a journalist for a newspaper whose wife watched me in To Be Wife, watched me in the TV debates and decided that that was the look she wanted for her husband for their wedding day.
Really?
Yeah.
What were you wearing?
It was some kind of suit and a tie.
I mean, that's not a great departure from what a lot of people wear on the wedding day.
Apparently it was a good look.
Wow.
Which I take no credit for.
Well, maybe you are on somebody's Pinterest board then. But we need to be clear here. We're not talking about fashion in the sense of how do Ed and I become fashion icons. We are talking about fast fashion. Now, what is fast fashion?
Well, this is the buy it, wear it, once, throw it away culture. There's sort of mind-boggling numbers on this and mind-boggling sort of injustices. I mean, the numbers in relation to the environment are that... clothes and the selling of clothes and the production of clothes is responsible for more carbon emissions than aviation and shipping put together.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, it's kind of unbelievable.
Yeah, because it's not something you hear talked about.
And it's something like 13,000 to 20,000 litres of water go into the production of one T-shirt. Which is shocking, isn't it?
It's
because
a lot,
of the cotton and, you know, the water for the cotton and all that to grow the cotton. And then the social sort of disaster. People remember the Rana Plaza disaster in Bangladesh. More than 1,000 people killed in a sort of sweatshop. You know, but that's just the sort of the kind of worst manifestation of it. You know, lots of people doing these jobs in the developing world in terrible conditions. So it's a real issue, and we'll be looking for solutions. And we've got a great lineup. We've got Lucy Siegel, environmental journalist and reporter from The One Show. Orsella De Castro, co-founder of Fashion Revolution, and my colleague Mary Cray, chair of the Environmental Audit Select Committee, which did a report on this whole issue recently published.
Can I just say, as Ed started talking about fast fashion, you might have heard, I don't know if it will pick up on the microphones, as a siren. I just want to show people it wasn't the fashion police. It was just
we've
just got the windows open as we record the podcast today. And then after all that, we are joined by comedian Josh Berry, who is also an impressionist. And I hear he can do a very good impersonation of a former Labour leader. And it's not Harold Wilson. So what's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, mine is actually about last week's episode, because it was about university admissions and who gets into university, who gets into Oxford, Cambridge, other universities. And blow me down.
Blow me down.
Is that a new...
It's another one, along with Crikey and Crumbs.
Do people not say blow me down?
I don't think, you know, for the past few decades, I don't think it's been in common usage.
Blow me down if, I say it again, if... Oxford doesn't announce an expansion of this Foundation Year scheme. V, who was on the podcast, was part of the Foundation Year scheme. And in the, you know, very nice of Oxford to do this, to coincide it with our episode, bump up the numbers, it announced that it was expanding the Foundation Year. I think only to 6 colleges so far. So I think they need to do a bit better. But I think Cambridge is talking about rolling out across the university. But at least it's a start. What's yours?
My reason to be cheerful this week is a slightly odd one on the face of it. I went to a funeral. My friend Brian died recently, and I went to his funeral on Monday. And first of all, the setting was incredible. It was at the University of Sussex in Brighton, and it was in the meeting house there. It's this beautiful... modernist building with loads and loads of windows, which each are coloured glass. So you got all this coloured light coming in, which was very appropriate because he'd been a lighting designer. That was his job, and he was of some renown. He'd worked with everyone from Manic Street Preachers, Coldplay, Britney Spears, Carole King. I mean, he was very, very well respected. But it was just one of these funerals where as people got up and talked about him, firstly, you realise that he'd lived 10 lives. Like he'd been an extra in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I never knew that about him. But just how much he'd touched other people. He'd mentored lots of people in his industry and you know, there was just a lot of love in the room for him. But the reason I thought I'd mention it was because he was diagnosed with cancer almost 10 years ago. And he's treated the last decade as a bonus decade. And him and his wife, Tracy, they travelled a lot. They saw the world. They sailed. They had amazing man. And then he spent this time, he called it his cancer bonus tour. He toured the country going back to venues that he had visited in his professional life, raising money for these causes close to his heart, which had given him this bonus, this sort of extra 10 years. And he really appreciated it. And
what an amazing bloke. Yeah. And I met him a few months ago.
Yeah, he was at Sarah's show.
Sarah's show.
Yeah, you know,
and I really enjoyed talking to him.
Committed socialist, born in the same house as Ramsay MacDonald, just an amazing man called Brian Leach.
Well, I'm really sad for you. But it was, you know, wife.
People talk about these things being celebrations, and often they can't help but be somber affairs. Yeah. And it was just really beautiful and really uplifting.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
To start our conversation, I'm delighted to say that we are joined on the line by Lucy Siegel, who's an environmental journalist and reporter on The One Show and author of a number of books, including To Die For, Is Fashion Wearing Out the World? Lucy, thank you so much for joining us.
It is a pleasure.
Let me start by asking how many pairs of jeans you own and why that is an okay question to ask for this topic.
It's a pivotal question. We all have too many pairs of jeans, or maybe you don't yourself, but, you know, cumulatively, if someone's got 19 pairs of jeans for you, do you know what I mean? So it's out of control, the amount of garments that we are buying. And jeans are where I really started this, because I noticed, this was back in probably about 2009 when I started really researching the fashion industry, I had 19 pairs of jeans. And only one or two did I actually like. So I saw the immediate disparity between the amount of product I had and number of wears. And I started to worry about what had got into making the 17 pairs of jeans, which I didn't really care for and didn't really fit me properly, and what I would do with them, what afterlife they would have, because I realised that they had a big environmental footprint. I felt bad.
So you've written a lot about the idea of fast fashion, which is maybe characterizes the industry. Talk to us about fast fashion and slow fashion. I mean, I think I might be a representative of slow fashion, but perhaps sort of unintentionally.
Well, good for you if you're a representative of slow fashion. We all need to be representatives of slow fashion. So fast fashion is a rapid system of production and manufacture, which is trend driven. So it's really decided by what is in fashion, which is getting faster and faster and faster. And it's sped up the cycle. So all the old qualities and characteristics that we associate with garments, such as their durability, the input of craft and their resilience, have all been sort of pushed out of the frame in favour of getting something that's bang on trend. And that also includes fabric choices. Now, one of the characteristics of fast fashion is it's super fast, but it's also super cheap. So we've experienced deflation in clothing prices over the last 30 years. The upshot of this is that we no longer have a textiles industry in the UK, when obviously we used to have a very significant industry in the UK, and that production has offshored, and it's offshored to low-wage economies. So when I wrote my book back in 2011, I estimated that 80 billion new garments were produced every year in the fast fashion, predominantly in the fast fashion system. And now, according to a recent McKinsey report, we're up to about 120 billion garments a year.
Wow.
So the problem that we have, as we do with all overproduction, is that there's nowhere for them to go. Another thing about fast fashion is that we've seen garments shift from durable, because clothing should be considered a durable item, into consumable, so it's almost regarded like you would a bottle of shampoo or whatever, and they are disposed of at an ever-increasing rate, which means we have a massive fast fashion waste problem, and waste is endemic in the fashion system. So that's fast fashion in a nutshell. The difference, slow fashion, is obviously to subvert all those qualities, a different system of production, which you hope will engender a different response in the consumer, so that we value our garments. We keep them in our wardrobes longer. The price point tends to be higher because we don't have all the subsidies that are in the fast fashion system, where we don't pay for the environmental chaos that we create. But the consumer has to offset that with increased price per wear.
How recent is this trend, Lucy? You know, is it our parents' generation, their parents' generation? I mean, it's got a lot worse.
Yeah, it's got faster and faster. So really, we've been in the grip of fast fashion proper for at least 2 decades, possibly nudging into 3 decades now since we started to offshore production. It's got much faster very recently because social shopping, so shopping for fashion on phones, for example, and on platforms like Instagram, where you can just swipe and, you know, touch the screen and you've bought the thing. That is the new way that consumers are being targeted. And with social shopping and these platforms, It sort of inculcates a sort of competitiveness as well. And then you hear young people sometimes saying, I can't be seen in this again because I've been photographed on Instagram or whatever. The purpose of clothing and the thing that made it sustainable is being subverted.
I understand that individual change has to be a huge part of this. We should be mending things. I understand the individual change. What could governments be doing better?
Well, there's a lot, really, because, you know, who's going to put the brakes on? Who's going to say you can't have these financial schemes that allow people to purchase really quickly and build up debt? So the trouble is that we've allowed the fashion sector, because it's kind of fun, it's always seen as really dynamic and a bit innocuous. I don't think it's been taken that seriously because I think its impact has been undervalued. We've allowed it to mark its own homework, which it's done with relish. But interestingly, a report just came out a couple of weeks ago, which is, it was really considered like an industry report, saying that all of these initiatives that the fashion sector has been allowed to set up in place of actual legislation are not working, and they're not on course to cut their emissions at the speed they need to cut their emissions. So it almost feels to me like the fashion industry is asking for some sort of constraints and intervention, whether it's levies on waste or it's to do with actually setting targets for the industry. We need to be much, much stronger and recognise and account for the impact that this industry is having.
What kind of targets would we be talking about for the industry, Lucy?
Well, I've got a kind of weird idea, but...
Oh, go on, yeah. We love weird ideas on this podcast, yeah.
Okay, bear with me. So,
no idea is too weird for this podcast.
I'll try you. But so basically, you've got all these carbon reduction targets, so decarbonisation. I think, honestly, the problem with the fashion industry is volume. So 120 billion new clothes each year from virgin resources is absolutely bonkers. Like, nobody needs to get dressed that many times, you know. It is all of this waste, all of this impact is happening, which we're all cleaning up, by the way. And citizens in low-wage economies and developing countries are really bearing the brunt of it. So we need to set them volume reduction targets. That's how we should be looking at this problem.
Interesting.
But, you know, I'm sure, like, free marketeers will absolutely love this idea. But that's the only way that we're going to solve this. A lot of the big brands in fast fashion are pretending that they're going to recycle their way out of this, okay? So the circular economy is going to do the heavy lifting for them. But actually, there's been a lot of research by scientific researchers looking at materials and textiles in particular, which shows why that is not really going to work. It's a volume issue. It's like energy use. You know, for alternative renewable energy to work, you really need to tackle usage overall.
I mean, I tell you what I think is really interesting about this conversation is that, you know, we've got this recommendation from the Climate Change Committee to have zero emissions by 2050. If we were really serious about this, we would have carbon budgets, not just for the government or the country as a whole, but for each department. Each industry would have to take its place within that thing. So, you know, in a way you could say, well, how is the fashion industry going to get to zero emissions? I mean, that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there anything like answered that question?
No, I mean, you know, even in the recent Environmental Audit Committee evidence sessions, a couple of the retailers just famously didn't turn up. So, you know, what could we do about this? And I think that those brands that like to message that they are ahead of sustainability, I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the individual, because we I'm sure you're right, it's about government action. As we've been speaking, I have taken my sort of fashion into my own hands and downloaded the Depop app.
Yes.
Tell us about what individuals can do and tell us about Depop.
I really like Depop because Depop is a kind of cool way of flogging your old clothes, basically.
And buying other people.
And buying other people's, exactly. But you can, if you've got an entrepreneurial mind and you know how to use social media properly, which obviously I don't. And it's all things like, you know, how you hold the shoe in the photograph. You know, it's like, will make a difference to how people...
Lord.
Oh, honestly, it's a whole new science, honestly. But there's value in it. So the whole thing with ethical fashion or sustainable fashion and slow fashion is that we're sort of saying it's going to be reductive, it's going to be less good, it's going to be less appealing, and, you know, all the joy is going to go out of it. And I think Depop, for me, puts the joy back in. And you can it's exciting. Will people bid on your shoes or whatever? What can you find on there? What can you discover? How can you market it? And it's really good for younger people who've got a slightly entrepreneurial kind of mindset, but know a lot about style and fashion. They can really showcase that. So I really like that mechanism of basically giving old clothes new value.
Well, look, I've just signed up as Jeff Lloyd, and I'm going to see how it goes. Lucy, what else can individuals do?
I would say the first thing to do is to follow my hashtag 30 wears rule. Do not passco, do not hand your card over if you cannot commit to wearing an item 30 times at the very least, because that's telling you that you don't need it, basically. So for some people that will seem like a terrible ordeal, and for some people are like, what, I've had this jumper for 30 years, never mind 30 times. So it's a good metric, just a clear thing to start out with.
It's bad news for people who get t-shirts printed for hen do's,
especially if you're still wearing them when the couples split up, which is what the slow fashion option will be. It's going to be awkward. So that's the thing, you see. When you get a piece of clothing, when you accept a piece of clothing into your life, it's for better or for worse, and you take responsibility. So if you've got something with someone's name on it, it's like a bit like getting a tattoo. You better be real, because you're stuck with that. And the best thing that you can do, I think, is join a rental service. So Rent the Runway, HURR, there's lots of different rental platforms coming up. If you've got a wedding to go to this summer, a big event, do you want to buy a whole outfit? No, you don't really. Imagine just being able to rent one for the weekend that was kind of absolutely just brilliant, like really fabulous pieces. Then you give them back. And also, you can get involved in that a little bit like Depop. You can run your own sort of little business from that as well. So you, if you invested in a coat that was more than you would usually pay, imagine that you would be able to rent that out and reclaim some of the value back.
We have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy.
Talking of weird things, Lucy.
Yeah. Which is a utopia with me as a benign leader. And if we were to appoint you Minister for Fashion, because neither Ed... Or I would have a clue. What is the first thing you would do at
government? Should be a minister for sustainable fashion.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think all fashion.
Or slow
fashion. I think all fashion should be both slow and sustainable.
Right,
so let's just keep it as minister for fashion.
Yeah, implicit. Yeah.
So what is the first thing you would do day one?
I haven't thought about this at all, obviously. I'd come up with some like card, like, you know, like a voucher card for Waterstones or what, you know, other purveyors are available, and you'd have your budget for the year on that fashion card, and you could spend it how you wished, but there'd be some incentive if you bought things that you were then going to rent out, because people are really competitive, especially about style and fashion. You can supplement your fashion budget by making your own pieces, adding your own pieces, customizing pieces. So we just basically reward people for being really creative and giving pieces an extra life.
Lucy, that is brilliant. I think she's got the job, don't you, Jess?
Definitely.
Have I?
Yeah.
When do I start?
Yeah. The dawn of the brave new world of the Jeffocracy. As soon as it happens, you're on speed dial.
Lucy Siegel, you've been great. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you.
On the line now, we have Ursula De Castro from Fashion Revolution, which is a campaign for reform of the fashion industry. Ursula, thank you for talking to us. And I wondered if you could start by telling us the story of what led you to set up Fashion Revolution and what Fashion Revolution is.
I've always been working in this space, in the sustainability in fashion field, since I was a designer. And Fashion Revolution was very much born as a direct result of the Rana Plaza disaster. Carrie Summers, Fashion Revolution's co-founder, called me just after the disaster saying, you know, something must be done. And we all felt that way, any one of us who had been involved in this particular area felt that the Rana Plaza disaster was both predictable and avoidable. And we all felt that something strong needed to happen.
So for people who don't know, what was the Rana Plaza disaster?
Well, so the Rana Plaza disaster happened in Dhaka, Bangladesh, in 2013. And it was the worst fashion industrial disaster in history. 1,138 people were killed and over 2,500 were injured. And this was because the factory complex they were working in was not safe. What I guess makes it all the more poignant was that the garment workers were aware of the fact their workspace was not safe. So many people died. Those things that they were making while feeling unsafe were nevertheless shipped out of the factories and reached our stores. And the Rana Plaza disaster would have been preventable had we had more transparency in the fashion supply chain and had we listened to the people that were fearing for their lives while in their place of work.
Just for the benefit of our listeners, if we take the social and the environmental sort of changes that are needed separately, on the social side, presumably this is about some pretty basic things about respect for workers' rights, people being able to work in non-hazardous conditions and not using child labour, that sort of suite of measures. Is that right?
It's safety in the workplace. It's, you know, education for their children. It's absolute, you know, payment of overtime and a dignified living wage.
And what progress have we made in the fashion industry on that side of things, would you say, since Rana Plaza, for example?
Not huge. I mean, you know, there have been brands that have been committing to paying a living wage, and we all know that they've not succeeded. You know, one of the deadlines was actually 2018. And although there has been an increase in certain factories that are piloting either, you know, equal pay for men and women, for instance, which is also really not very standardized in this industry, but also, you know, the paying garment workers, you know, fairly certainly more than a minimum wage. But it's complicated due to the fact that there are multiple brands producing in many of these factory clusters, and therefore some brands will be demanding the living wage and others won't be taking it into their considerations.
And then on the environmental side, it's maybe clearer to our listeners what the answers are on the social side, but on the environmental side, give us a sense of the sort of different answers that there could be to the fact that, you know, fast fashion is responsible for lots of carbon emissions, yeah, and has all these problems.
At Fashion Revolution, our hashtag, Who Made My Clothes, which is really about, you know, giving visibility to supply chain workers, is huge and has been really effective in creating more dialogue and further connections on the social aspect. But when it comes to the environment, there is something that we can do every day when we wake up. And that is to think that, you know, the fashion supply chain starts with our own wardrobes. So to understand what we buy and what their environmental impact is hugely important.
You mentioned the hashtag Who Made My Clothes. You know, our listeners often want to get involved in the ideas we talk about. You've got something called Fashion Revolution Week. What is a way that people can engage with this?
If you go on our Fashion Revolution website, which is www.fashionrevolution.org, we are so imaginative when it comes to giving our audience and citizens ways to become involved, because we understand that fashion is really individual. So what works for one isn't going to work for somebody else. You know, it could be about really focusing on secondhand, on mending, on repair. But we equally have ways that citizens can really keep their brands accountable, from reading our Fashion Transparency Index to sending one of our postcards to the brands. Again, you can do it on our website, ensuring that brands do let us know who makes our clothes.
Ursula, one last thing. We have a thing on the podcast. It's a paradise found. It's a utopia called the Jeffocracy with me as a supreme leader. Now, if you were... If you were appointed Minister for Fashion... And
that's
I think,
my reaction as well, Ursula.
I think I would be very hands-off in this particular ministry. What is?
Let's hope so, my goodness. I don't want you as a Minister for Fashion.
Says you! What is the first thing... I mean, I don't even know how you're still getting clothes from C&A in 2019.
Yeah, all right.
So the first thing is that I would get the entire government sewing. So, you know, during those boring sessions, at least... mend your clothes. But really what I would do on a serious level would be all around education. So first of all, I believe that we need to reintroduce the arts with a particular focus on making into schools. You know, that should be back in the curricula. And in fact, I'm very proud to say that we collaborated with the Environmental Audit Committee and Mary Cray very closely on the committee. And I'm delighted that that was also one of their recommendations. I believe that, you know, we cannot imagine a future with, you know, with us nurturing generations that can do little more but just scrolling. So back to making.
Ursula De Castro, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And joining us now in Jeff's house is Mary Cray, Labour MP for Wakefield, Chair of the Environmental Audit Committee. And Jeff, I can tell you there's something about Mary.
There is something about Mary.
Mary Cray is such a multi-talented woman that she arrived and I found her mending your hedge, if that's not the wrong way of putting it.
Yeah, my hedge is, it looks like it's been fossilized. It's been hit by a certain type of green caterpillar, I believe, which is terrorizing hedges in North London. But Mary has solutions for me, so thank you.
Look, let me just tell you about Mary. She saved the forests when she was Shadow Defra spokeswoman.
Yes. So a hedge should be easy then,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so she saved the badgers-ish.
Yeah, well, the badgers moved the goalposts, so we got rid of Caroline Spelman and Owen Watson, but yeah.
I tell you, she can definitely save your hedge.
Okay.
You're going to save his hedge, aren't you,
Defo.
Mary?
We've got solutions.
Good. Great. But we're here to talk about your inquiry that you've done as chair of the Environmental Audit Committee into fast fashion.
Yeah.
Which is our subject this week. Tell us about why you did the inquiry.
Well, the Ellen MacArthur Foundation did a report that said if our current fashion consumption carries along its same path, it will be a quarter of our carbon budget by 2050.
Jesus.
I know.
And it's more than aviation and shipping at
combined,
the moment. Yeah,
combined. So it's like you think about all of the flights and how guilty you feel about the flights. I mean, obviously, you're not wearing all of the clothes in the world, so you don't have to feel guilty about the clothes you're wearing. But
guilty about quite a lot of my clothes.
Yeah, you should. Crimes against
fashion.
That's
for other reasons. I've gotten more of another reason to feel guilty, a more important reason to feel guilty.
I think it's nice that your mum still dresses.
Oh, you rotter. He's looking quite decent this morning.
No, I think I'm the example of slow fashion.
I think you're right. Yeah, you're...
I've still got my Oxford University Labour Club t-shirt from 25 years ago.
I've still got my anti-apartheid t-shirt from 1990. So look, we all have these heritage garments. And the thing is, we need more heritage garments. We want the stuff that you think, I can't get rid of those socks because I walked up the Himalaya in them. They're red, they're wool, they've got a massive hole in them. But
but
I'm going to keep them and I'm going to one day I'll darn them. Someone taught me how to darn, but I don't want.
And
to.
We are the worst in Europe, are we?
Yeah, so we consume twice as many clothes as the Italians and they don't look shabby, do they?
They certainly don't.
No,
in fact, Italian men always look miles better than us.
So we're overbuying, we're underutilizing, and what that means is all our wardrobes are stuffed full of clothes that we don't wear. So a quarter of the British wardrobe isn't worn.
What are we going to do then?
Well,
what's a sustainable fashion industry?
Well, fashion, look, they've been marking their own homework for years. So all they sell us is fun, frocks, frills, cheap frills is what I wanted to call the report, but they wouldn't have me. Let me do it. It's like, come on, let's have a pun. I did get the only pink report that's ever been published by the House of Commons.
I think they call that millennial pink.
Milkshake pink. There are many solutions. So fashion's basically like, we've signed up to the Sustainable Clothing Action Plan, and that means we're going to reduce our waste, water and carbon footprints. And then we looked at how well they'd done, and they had reduced some of their water footprints. They had reduced their carbon footprints, although how do they measure the carbon? We can get into scope 3 emissions if you want to. Waste, it was like, we haven't tackled waste. So what we said is a penny on every garment. That would raise £35 million a year, and they would have to collect their own waste back in store. Now, some stores already do this, H&M. H&M encourages you to bring back your clothes, to take back your clothes so that they can be recycled. Arcadia, all the Topshop, doesn't. So they've got one take back.
What would your levy do?
So it would raise £35 million. So it basically says you have to start collecting them. You have to start collecting points in every store in every city. And then every city would then have, 10,000 tons of textiles a year to deal with.
Well, you
and
could
then
bring back any clothes or just the ones
any
you
clothes.
H&M.
And the difficult things is, you know, what do you do with your ratty old knickers? What do you do with your socks with your holes in? It's like, you can't give them to the charity shop. It's too embarrassing. Yeah. They have a value as a fabric, as a stuffing, etc. So
recycling them is
recycling. So charity shop, recycling.
What else?
We want people to reconnect with their clothes. So this is quite hard, but when I was at school, and perhaps you as well, Ed, did you learn embroidery? You probably did woodwork. I did sewing, I did knitting. Really,
I did embroidery, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah,
good man.
I was really bad at woodwork and metalwork. I don't think we did embroidery, but
I think we had the choice, and given the choice between woodwork, metalwork and embroidery, I thought, I'm more of an embroidery kid.
So we don't teach our kids that stuff anymore. And all that the children are being taught is, you know, get your Instagram photo out. The girls are being taught to consume it, to buy it online, to get into debt, to wear it once, to send it back. Huge carbon footprint with these online deliveries as well. Much less efficient than going into a store. And so what we're saying is teach kids how to make and mend their own clothes. And then when they realise how much making and work goes into something, they won't be as keen to just chuck it in the bin.
How do we sort the environmental part of this? I mean, is it just a big cultural change? I mean, you're quite clear, aren't you, that it's not just about leaving it to individuals, although you talked about individuals, but it's, you know, you need government also to do its bit.
The government's just announced these 12,000 companies are going to have to report their greenhouse gas emissions. Well, the government announced that they all had to report on modern slavery, but Foot Locker and Versace haven't got that statement on their forward-facing website. So that you announce stuff, and then if you don't actually monitor and audit it, you know, the good ones do it and the bad ones get a free pass. So if we're going to create regulations and we're going to measure carbon, then it's got to be part of their annual accounts. And it should be alongside your physical accounts. And you basically say, this is what our stores in the UK use. This is what our mobile delivery service used. This is what our ship coming from China or our plane coming from Turkey used. And these are what our factories used over wherever they are. And you start measuring that, and then you say, we're going to reduce that footprint. And then you've got a plan of how you're going to do it.
Now, we've got a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, which is Jeff as the supreme ruler.
I'm very hands off. I would be very busy tending to my isn't a privet hedge.
He'd be sort of battling the caterpillars. If he made you Minister for the Environment with special responsibility for fashion, what's the first thing you do? And by the way, Mary, there's going to be no sort of issues of having to sort of, you know, Jeff will just tick it off.
In the fashion space, I think we have to...
You're unconstrained. You don't have to worry about your select committee keeping everyone on board.
No. Well, that's great. I would bring in this extended producer responsibility, and I would probably not make it a penny a garment. I'd make it 2 or 5p a garment.
Or even 10.
Or ramp it up over 5 years.
And what would extended producer responsibility mean?
That creates the money for the industry to work out how it's going to recycle and reuse its clothes, and incentivizes them to make less.
You could even have a percentage, couldn't you? It
you
doesn't
could.
Need to be a flat fee.
It's
so the more
simpler.
Expensive clothes, yeah, true, but it's more expensive
you could,
clothes.
Yeah, they'll game it if you do it on retail
this
price.
This is what it used to be like when Mary and I were that one.
We'd
have these
policy
I
ideas.
Would have these like slightly nerdy kind of, perhaps we should do as a percentage.
So Valentino pays more. I'm sure if you're spending £500 on a Valentino jumper, you're probably not chucking it out to the charity shop. Or if you are, you're doing it as an auction, you know. So I don't think they're not the problem. The problem is the volume when you go in, and it's the It's the fact that we don't wear stuff. So it's about trying to change our mindset as well. And that whole thing about, you know, being closer to our clothes and and appreciating the value of the work. And it's mostly women's work. This is women's manual labour we're talking about that goes into it. And I think the other thing I would do is compulsory knitting classes, because knitting is a brilliant protection against depression. There's been studies done into it. It's just so soothing and satisfying. And I would like us to have knitting in the commons.
Knitting in the commons.
La tricoteuse.
Knitting with Mary. Mary Cray, you have been something special as always. Thank you so much for joining us. So what did you think?
Well, it was an eye-opener. I had no idea before we started looking into this week's episode of the impact that the fashion industry made environmentally. And I think there are a lot of good ideas we heard about what the individual can do, but this needs regulation, doesn't it?
Yeah, I really like the sort of Lucy Siegel sort of big hammer.
Yeah.
Of all areas, this is an area where individuals' behaviour can definitely make a difference. But as I've said before in relation to sort of carbon emissions and climate change, I think this is an area where you do need system change. And so I really liked some of Lucy's ideas, particularly on this. It sounds like a really interventionist thing, but this volume thing, or even my, you know, the slight variant, which is the carbon budgets, you know, the fashion industry would have to just be within certain carbon budgets. I mean, I think you do need system change, but obviously as individuals, we can make a difference. Now, Depop might not necessarily do it for me, because it's about sort of 30 years younger than me, in terms of the age range. But I think thinking about what we do ourselves is also important.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
If you've got thoughts on fast fashion, my fashion, Jeff's fashion, or any other ideas for future episodes, please do get in touch. Reasons at cheerfulpodcast.com, at cheerfulpodcast on Twitter, and on Instagram and facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. Big response to our episode on university admissions. This is from Phil in Salford. Dear Ed and Jeff, thanks for making the podcast almost exactly the same length as my cycle commute. I listened with great interest at episode 87.
You wouldn't believe the amount of observing you on your commute we've had to do to get the data to get it to exactly the right length.
Yeah, those sort of, you know, cameras and all that. It's a topic I feel passionate about. The crucial point is that is always left out in these debates is the disparity in applications to Oxbridge between state and privately educated pupils really matters. If you don't apply, you don't go. Using statistics published by Oxford and the Office for National Statistics, it's easy to show that privately educated pupils are over three times more likely to apply to Oxford than state school pupils, around 1 in 10 compared to less than 1 in 30. Taking that into account gives around a 1 in 5 chance of being accepted if you're state educated compared to a 1 in 4 chance if you're privately educated. Not such a huge difference after all, much of which can be explained by differences in subject. State educated pupils favour courses such as medicine that are oversubscribed, while privately educated pupils favour courses such as classics that are undersubscribed. When you hear the experience of the brightest state-educated students, such as V, the difference in applications is hardly surprising. Too many state schools are not encouraging their brightest pupils to apply, and in some cases are actively discouraging them. This is not Oxford's fault or responsibility. All in all, Oxford and Cambridge come under huge criticism for biases that are neither as big as they seem nor their making. We should instead be focusing on providing support to every secondary school in the country so they can provide support for their brightest students with highest aspirations. That's what I think anyway. Carry on. So what do I think about Phil's comments? I think it's right to say that we should think about who applies. I think it's worth saying, though, that according to the Sutton Trust, even on the basis of who applies, if you look at Oxbridge acceptance rates, about 22% of those from comprehensives get accepted, compared to a third, 34%, of those from independent schools. So there is still a difference. And secondly, you know, we need to invest in state schools so that, you know, among other things, they can help people to apply. But I think Oxbridge also has a responsibility, because there are people who think Oxbridge isn't for them because of its image. And Oxbridge is partly responsible for that. And they've got to do more to get out there and engage with people. And then, given that the acceptance rates are still different, they've got to think about, you know, the whole design of their interview and other processes as to who gets in and who doesn't.
This comes from Olivia Rainford, and this is sort of reflective of a few emails that we received. Olivia says, I'm the head of alumni and fundraising at London South Bank University. We've won University of the Year for 2 years running to no avail with regard to the ridiculous connotations of widening access and the concept of top universities. And I was disappointed to not hear any reference to non-Russell Group institutions. There are many points to share, but at the very least, I would like to see broadcast agendas on social mobility talking to those of us delivering social mobility. I'd be happy to introduce you to the phenomenal stories that showcase how gaining a degree is not fundamentally an elitist structure. And this is something we sort of talked about. And the fact is that the elite, at the moment, as it stands, come from Oxford and Cambridge. Now, that's a problem in itself, and that's worth an episode or multiple episodes probably in itself. But just on that issue, as the system is what it is, what can be done to broaden the pool from which that elite is drawn? That's what we're trying to get at with the episode, wasn't
it? And I just don't, I think it's a correct point to say one mustn't just buy into the only kind of decent universities are the Russell Group or etc., or the notion that they're necessarily the top. And I think that's a kind of well pointed out point. But the fact is that the structure of our society at the moment tends to really help people who get into those top universities, so-called top universities. And, you know, we need to address that issue as well as addressing all of the, you know, society structures.
But it was just, I don't want people to think it's our only and last word on universities.
No.
Yeah, that was just that one particular issue of how do you broaden access to those universities, and then hopefully the elite looks more representative.
But I think there's a fair point, which is the elite shouldn't just come from those universities.
Of course not.
And we totally buy that, and that point is well taken. This one comes from Martha Powell. Dear Ed and Jeff, I enjoyed the recent episode on access to the top universities, particularly V's experience, which I'm sure is mirrored in state schools across the UK. I also attended a state school, and with regards to university admissions, applying to Oxbridge had a very different impact that I thought I would share. In our school, how many students applied, got interviews at, and ultimately got into Oxbridge was a measure of success for the sixth form. Thus, students planning on applying to Oxbridge got extra tuition, interview prep, and personal statement classes. I made a conscious choice not to apply for Oxbridge, as it seemed too high pressure. However, this decision caused me and many other pupils who had made this call to miss out on this help with the university admissions process, leaving us more or less on our own. It's absolutely an issue that students at V were told no to applying to Oxbridge as a result of their circumstances and education, but I think the perception surrounding Oxbridge and the achievement schools feel when one of their students does get in can disadvantage state school students in more than one way. I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, these three contributions do show some of the complexity of this issue.
Yeah, and we're not done with universities, and we're certainly not done with
social... did one already on universities, on marketisation of universities.
Yeah.
But we'll also come back to some of these issues.
Email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast. Or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Before we move on to ideas, which hopefully will be reasons to be cheerful and make the country and the world a better place, Ed, are you looking forward to our live show on the South Bank?
Well, Jeff, let me tell you, throw it away. What an absolute privilege it's going to be for me and you. It's just going to be so great. I can't even tell you.
Yeah, all right, all right.
How are you feeling? How are you feeling about this? Is Josh Berry? How are you feeling about Josh's impersonation of you?
I don't like him already.
He hasn't hit me yet.
What is the key to doing Ed then?
Adenoids.
You got the throat away. It's exactly that. Just full of adenoidal.
Do you feel like you need to inhabit Ed's physicality when you're doing an impersonation? Are you watching mannerisms as well? Is there some key to sort of unlocking them?
Yeah, I think it depends on the person, actually. I wouldn't say, Ed, that you have as many sort of physical tics, but certainly some people do, like he said, just twitching off my... You know, I think Andy Murray is a really good example of someone who's sort of that physicality, just rubbing your face all the time is a really good, you know, he has a lot of physical tics, but not everyone does.
And is it the case that you generally sort of either get it or you don't. I mean, is it, in other words, is it is some,
that's true of life, Jeff.
Is it something? Yeah. Do you need to work on an impersonation for a long time, or do you just think, oh yeah, I can get that person quite easily?
I think it depends on the person. Sometimes, wonderfully, it can happen really quickly. Like you know, when I first learned to do Prince Harry, it sort of happened pretty fast, and I was like, whoa, you know. I sound as though I could do with a packet full of Strepsils. But other people are sort of works in progress for a much longer time and take ages to refine.
Who are you struggling with at the moment?
Well, I struggled with Russell Brand for a while, but I would like to think that it's at a good level now. Or he's one of my laws. So should we get into that?
Oh, okay. So you've come along with some ideas.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with the one which some way involves Russell Brand?
I thought I was quite a liberal guy before coming on here, but a lot of these are sort of based around censorship. And this first one is put a cap on the amount of media exposure that Russell Brand gets in a year. I'm a bit sick of him. You know, kind of giving his theories on life and sort of, you know, on his podcast being like,
you know, inherently, mate, I think that life is sort of intrinsically in life just a bit thesaurus and colonoscopy and synonyms, really, mate.
Because what is it? It's just some sort of spirituality, isn't it? I don't know. I just don't think there's much substance.
So he kind of goes from high to low then.
Yeah, he's got lots of different voices. So there's always that, you know, I suppose really intrinsically there's that one. And then there's the much more sort of breathy one, you know, where he's doing naughty things on the radio, which we probably shouldn't talk about. Whoa!
All right, Josh, what else do you have?
I would like on the syllabus to teach children in primary schools philosophy. I think that would be a really beneficial thing for broader learning and sort of a style of thinking.
Can you do your Wittgenstein first, please?
That impression.
Yeah.
I you've teed me up there. I can give you some David Mitchell instead.
Nearly.
Let's be honest, who would even want to hear that? Just a nasal voice going on and on repeatedly. There you go. I gave you another impression. Thank you.
Are you ever tempted to give voices to historical characters, though?
Well, nobody could like countermand you on Wittgenstein.
Yeah, sure. I don't know how big a market there is for Wittgenstein.
Wittgenstein impressions.
Yeah. Could be my next Edinburgh show.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. Why do you want to teach children philosophy?
I just think it's a style of thinking that would really benefit them going through life. It just, not in terms of, you know, I'm not asking them to look at sort of ethical proofs and, you know, critique religious philosophical ideas, but it's more just getting children to question knowledge and not take knowledge for granted, which I think is a really beneficial attitude. That's
I'm into it. What's
good.
Next?
I'm pleased. I would like for there to be an Andy Murray Day every year. And this is, yes, an obvious way for me to shoehorn in, you know, my impression of Andy Murray, which I'm now doing. But I think, as I continue in Andy Murray, that, you know, Boxing Day, what do we really use it for? We could just sort of share that holiday with Andy Murray every other year, you know.
Is he your greatest hit?
You get a lot of work out of it, Josh. I can't help feeling, wouldn't you?
If yeah, I just well,
if there's
yeah.
an international Andy Murray Day.
Yeah, sure. But you know, we're all constrained by capitalism at the end of the day.
And
really.
you do a radio show as Andy Murray.
I do. I used to. Yeah. Now he features in it. He features in the new series, which is called Josh Berry's Fake News, which. Yeah, throws him in.
And have you had any personal contact with Andy Murray?
I have also had personal contact.
Have you?
Yeah, I did. Rather like this wonderful thing we had earlier, I did an impression of him to him, which was good fun.
Was he appreciative?
He was, more so than you.
Oh, is there anybody whose impression of them you wouldn't want them to hear?
Probably Ed's, actually, in hindsight. my Jacob Rees-Mogg is not the most flattering, and that's the one we're going to come on to in a minute. But I don't know. I think it is... Possibly. I think it's quite a flattering thing if someone's taken the time to, you know, learn your voice.
I'm flattered.
Thank you, Ed. Yep. I'm pleased.
Definitely flattered.
Well, you've dangled a carrot there for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's hear this idea then.
I would like for Jacob Rees-Mogg to be followed around by a fact checker. Now, practically, I'm not sure how this will work, but this is kind of inspired by a specific instance. I don't know if you saw on Question Time a few months ago, he said of Boer War concentration camps. Well, you know, the death rate was actually the same as in Glasgow. The problem with Mogg is that he's so charismatic and has such a confidence that I think people just trust innately, you know, what he's saying, because he's telling you he's right.
Your Jacob Rees-Mogg is very good.
Well, thank you very much.
Do you do any other politicians?
You know, I think everyone's got a Donald Trump. Everyone sort of, all the impressionists do that one. It's pretty standard. Boris, of course. You know, you don't need to say words. You can just go. And, of course, Theresa May. Boo-hoo.
So, Josh, if people want to enjoy more of your work, how can they experience that?
Well, they can experience it through their ears on Apple Podcasts. I'm coming to the end of my series, Josh Berry's Fake News on Union Jet Radio, which has been a lot of fun. And please do buy tickets to come and watch me visually and experience me hourly and with all of your senses, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Josh Berry, thanks so much.
Thanks for coming. Thank you.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, over the course of the podcast, there has been a development about where you've had Blow Me Down from.
Wow, Blow Me Down!
It's the unmistakable voice of Popeye the Sailor Man.
Yeah, and the good thing about the internet is it can sort of lead you to believe anything. So there seems to be some school of thought that it originated from a 1933 Popeye film called Blow Me Down.
Oh, there we go. Well, Blow Me Down. Well,
yeah.
And it's good to see that you're keeping it alive almost 90
years
later.
How did you feel about Popeye?
I liked
I'm strong to the finish because I eat my spinach. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. Doot, doot.
I have to say, it's not your strongest impersonation.
Really?
I mean, it was a nice rendition of the song, but I don't think you had
What did
much
you think of the doot doot?
Now, that was good. Yeah, yeah.
I'm good at my doot doot. Yeah. Should I do my doot doot with my
Yeah, maybe throw in a bit of Boots and Cats as well.
Maybe I should release it as a Christmas record.
Yeah, or maybe you should do it on stage at the next live show.
Perhaps not.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you've got that kind of genius, you can't have it sort of forced. You know, it's just got to
come.
No,
it's a gift.
Yeah, but it's got to sort of come up through your waters.
You don't want to hide your light under a bushel. The public, we're living through troubling times.
No, that's true.
You know, people need you to share your gift with them, Ed.
Yeah, my gift.
Yeah. We should thank our guests. So Lucy Siegel, I thought, was wonderful with her sort of strong. It was the iron fist, really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For dealing with the fashion industry. Ursula de Castro from Fashion Revolution was marvellous.
Yeah.
As
and
was
Mary Cray,
yeah,
who's dealing with utopiary.
She is, yeah. she's basically got an idea that when she teaches us how to get rid of the box moth,
the killer caterpillar
from our hedge, she then is going to help us sculpt it in true topiary style into your head in hedge form.
Are you serious?
Yeah, no, of course I'm not serious. I genuinely honestly think you would like that.
I do.
Turning up every week,
I can have a selfie with it.
Well, if anybody, you know, if anybody,
and also if for some reason I was indisposed one week, the hedge could fill it for me.
If anybody's listening to this who's good at topiary, if you were willing to cut your own hedge, not mine, into Ed's head, would you go and have a selfie with it?
I'd take it under advisement. I've learned my lesson.
And thanks to Josh Berry as well, who could also stand in for you.
Yeah.
If you're not here one week.
Emma Corsham produced our podcast with backup and research from Joel Pierce and Joe Kenyon. Ed C did our music, James Deacon did our idents, Gail Lofthouse is our announcer, and our artwork is done by
Emily Power.
You did that rather well.
Thank you. I never usually get to do that, so I thought I'd do it with a bit of gusto.
You did do it with a bit of gusto.
He's been strung to the finish because he eats his spinach.
He's been doot doot.
And these have been
reasons to be cheerful.